Mother Earth is psychedelic. Her body is covered with psychoactive, sacred medicine. Can psychedelics help us become more conscious and loving parents, partners, lovers, and leaders? Welcome to the Psychedelic Mom Podcast. I'm your host, Michaela Carlin, the Psychedelic Mom, a mother and entrepreneur partnering with Mother Earth's sacred plant medicines to heal, awaken, and learn to live in alignment to my truth. Psychedelic literally means soul revealing. What reveals the soul to oneself is psychedelic. I invite you to join me in deep conversations with leaders, healers, seekers, and other parents. I will share my journey, the wisdom, practices, medicines, and mistakes that have changed my life, and personal stories of others on this wild path. We are the medicine needed to birth the more beautiful world we know is possible. Welcome to the Psychedelic Mom Podcast. I am here today with Dr. Ben Malcolm. Ben, how are you today?
I'm doing really well. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, good to see you. I have a subscription with your program, so I wanted to bring you on because many times you have helped me out looking at someone's health form, and that's been vital for me. So your expertise is bar none out there in the field. Dr. Ben Malcolm got his bachelor degree in pharmacology, master's in public health, and then a doctorate in pharmacology. And first, I want to ask you how you even got on this path. It's almost like you had a crystal ball knowing this was all coming.
I wish. I didn't have a crystal ball and I knew it was all coming. It was kind of like, I would say that I had an intellectual curiosity about psychoactive drugs as a teenager that most teenagers don't. Many have an experiential curiosity, and I would say the intellectual curiosity eventually led there, but I just started looking at particularly addictive drugs. I was just interested in their mechanisms and why they caused addiction and things like that. And by looking at addictive and illegal sorts of substances, I came across MDMA and psilocybin, and the trajectory of those experiences, the patterns of use that people were reporting, the sorts of benefits and feelings that they would have afterwards were just so much different than your opioids, your cocaine, your stimulants, that it like inspired me to like want to try. I did try them. They were wonderful in college. And that sort of led me, I was playing didgeridoo at the time. I was interested in like world music. So it led me to take some courses in like Native American religion and world music. And that's kind of where I really kind of stumbled upon like true sacramental use of entheogens and the idea that if you ingest them in particular spiritual sets and settings or religious sets and settings, then there's a very high likelihood that you're going to have this kind of like mystical experience or God encounter or bona fide religious experience or peak spiritual experience. You can find it kind of like sliced and diced different ways depending on what kind of literature you're looking through. But at that point in time, something clicked. This was like senior year of undergraduate, right? So it would have been around 2007, 2008. Like something kind of clicked that there is a biological basis to these spiritual experiences. Or there's a spiritual basis to biological experiences, depending if you know which way you look through the universe. But you know, this is 2008. Like Hopkins had just published their kind of like first trials demonstrating that psilocybin could produce a mystical sort of subjective effect. But we weren't really in the era of there's randomized trials in persons with mental illnesses demonstrating unprecedented benefits yet. So between 2008 and 2016, I did a whole lot more school. That's when I went to graduate school and got to pharmacy, a master's in public health degree, worked in a pharmacy for a couple of years. Was in like a hospital residency after pharmacy school, and something just kind of clicked at that point where it's like, you know what? The most interesting thing to me is the thing that I found most interesting at the start of the day. It's like a dozen years later, and you have like three more degrees at this point. It's 2016. There's a research scene now. There have been trials published for MDMA for PTSD or psilocybin for depression, anxiety associated with life-threatening illness. there's a lot of serious interest in studying it for depression and things like that at this point. And so I was like, hey, there's a real evidence base for a pharmacist to stand upon here. There's a lot of misinformation I see floating around social media that I think a pharmacist would be in a good position to like write about and correct. And then through some other friends that just had questions about screening, it became apparent that a pharmacist would be really helpful in kind of an upstream preparation clinical screening process too. And that was really how Spirit Pharmacist got born around 2016, 2017 or so.
I love your mission, this idea of using what your kind of view for psychedelics is and your hope that they could be used as psychospiritual, personal, ceremonial, and the treatment of mental health. So when we look at that, as the psychedelic mom, I'm always looking at this word psyche as, yes, it's either mind but soul, what reveals the soul. When you look at these psychedelic medicines, in your own personal experience that led you down this path, what would you say that your own experience with these medicines was that made you not just see the kind of biological aspects, but also the spiritual aspects of these?
I'd say I was like extremely hard-headed around spirituality until like age 25. Like I identified as probably like an atheist through the end of undergraduate, at least. Probably more like closer to the age like 24, 25, there was like a real turning point. And it was a DMT experience that was the turning point. I think at that point in time, I was kind of like, you know, I didn't like the religious cliche, everything happens for a reason and there's a purpose and a meaning in life. I'd always been like, it's chaos and absurdity. And it really came from like my high school English teacher because they weren't allowed to like read the religious novels in the English class, like AP English or whatever. So she just picked all of the atheist existential literature, like John Paul Sartre and Albert Camus and like things like that. So I think I got like really kind of like shaped by that slash. I really despise the dogma of religion and just felt that it was at the root of so many of the world's problems as far as like violence and war, colonialism, climate change. Like I really think that like the religious belief, for example, that's like, it's kind of in the Bible, like that God made the world for man. That core belief in itself, okay, so it didn't make it for any plants, didn't make it for any animals. It's like, okay, so what? This is like man's treasure chest just to plunder and do whatever they want with. And that really seems to be a belief that is playing out and causing catastrophic levels of damage. So to this day, I am not big on religion, but I've opened up a lot to spirituality, and psychedelics were definitely part of that. And part of it was my choice, too. It was kind of like, okay, bro, you're 25 years old. You believe that life doesn't really have a purpose. So that makes it pretty comfortable to sit around smoking pot in your underwear playing internet poker all day, because what else are you going to do with life? There's no meaning to it. So why would you go out and find anything to do with it? And there was something that just kind of clicked. It was like, dude, your beliefs shape your world. And if you believe that life is this chaotic, absurd thing with no rhyme or reason to it, and it doesn't have a purpose, then you're probably not ever going to feel like your life has a purpose. Whereas maybe you don't have to like do it with like gusto levels of faith, but let's just try on a different belief for a little bit of time. Let's just pretend that that's the truth for some amount of time. And if you did have a purpose, what would it be? 12 years later, here I am.
So 12 years later, after kind of going down this path with entheogens and earth medicines, and I imagine you've had them in ceremonial settings. Have you ever had them in a therapeutic setting as well?
No, I've never really done like with a sit down with a therapist, do psychedelic assisted therapy. I've done much more like ritual or like retreat style things. Frankly, I'm kind of a solo tripper. That's always been my almost like preferred set and setting overall.
And where would you say today, that many years later, due to these medicines, you went through kind of those existential questions, what they taught you?
Yeah, again, I think it taught me that your beliefs shape your world and that to keep your beliefs fluid. Like even as a teenager, before I tried any psychedelic, as 15 years old, people would be like, what's your spirituality? And I would say, it's Benjaminism. It's a form of spirituality that is for Ben and Ben only, and Ben reserves his right to change the mind at any possible point to fit his worldview now. That's what I'm following, and not following anyone else's word, not following oh, okay, Benjaminism as an 18-year-old, it's practiced differently as a 37-year-old, right? But it's still the same kind of thing. And man, you know, I don't know, so many different lessons at different points in your life, different things going on. Even in college, right, I would say like experiences were mostly recreational types of experiences, but there was something that was recognized that, man, every time I do this recreational thing, I learn something about myself. And, you know, I don't like the idea of drugs having moral characters, like a drug is good or a drug is bad. But back at that point, even as like a 19-year-old, I'd kind of figured out that a bad drug is a drug that could get you high, but will leave you lower than when you began. A good drug is a drug that might get you high and might make you feel kind of challenged or dysphoric in some way, but it leaves you in a better place. Because if you've leveled up, it leaves you in a better place. You're not going to be tempted to use a big higher dose to achieve something. You're not chasing the experience. Whereas like all the other addictive drugs that get you high and then you go low, particularly when they're very short acting, the tendency is always to use more, to chase, to go higher, because you're dumped lower each time. So that was like one aspect of it. You know, the first few times I took MDMA or ecstasy at parties, I was on the swim team at the time. I was like, it's basically an athletic fraternity, right? And we would not do it excessively at all. It was like once a quarter max kind of thing. It would have to be a very, very special kind of occasion. And every time I did it, I would go around to everyone on the swim team and tell them all the things I appreciated about them. And about the third time that happened, I was just kind of like, man, there's something about MDMA that just makes me like gush compliments to everyone. And then I started thinking, why is that? And I came to the conclusion that, well, it's not that MDMA makes you want to gush compliments. It's just that your fear holds you from complimenting people normally. And it became a social anxiety type of, you have these thoughts, you know, I like your shirt, whatever, that's going through your head all the time, but you don't come out and say it. And probably because you're programming, right? Like, it's like, okay, coming out of my teenage years, it's like, definitely don't compliment a male. If you compliment a female, then you're flirting and coming on to her and this and that. And I just was just kind of like, all right, I better not say anything nice to anyone, was what I'd like learned out of that, which is, you know, absurd. Because if you really compliment someone and it really is coming from a platonic place, persons can feel that energy and they just like it and they say thank you and that's it. So even as in college with recreational experiences, I got in my head that I'm going to practically start integrating these types of things by next time when something nice comes through your head, your job is to say it out loud to the person, even if it feels a little scary or something.
Does MDMA do something to the fear receptors in the brain? Is that what it's doing?
That's what I think. I think it diminishes, I would say, like reactionary, like egoic reactionary mechanisms and like fear-based mechanisms. And you hear people talk about MDMA or ecstasy like colloquially as like a heart opener. And it's kind of like, you know what? It might be more accurate to call it a fear reducer than a heart opener. I think, for example, if you reduce fear, it's the heart opens as like a natural byproduct of that. Because if you're very afraid and scared, then you're going to be sort of contracted, hunched over, body closed kinds of like positions. But if you reduce the fear, the heart will kind of like open. So I'm not really sure like which way it is or if it's a bidirectional effect, but people call MDMA a heart opener. And I'm always like, well, but mechanistically, a lot of the science talks about it as being a fear reducer, and fear reduction could be something that naturally makes a person want to be open, emotionally vulnerable, that kind of thing.
What are the questions that you get asked most often?
Oh, mostly stuff about medications and contraindications and a lot of like, will I die if I mix this together types of questions. The answer is usually no. Sometimes, depending on which psychedelic you're talking about. Occasionally, I do get someone that it's just like sounds like kind of a bad idea.
I know you work with a lot of people to get them either off their pharmaceuticals to then try earth medicines. What is the data that we have now of people who choose to get off a pharmaceutical, an SSRI or a mood stabilizer, and go the path of earth medicines? Do they go back on their SSRIs? Do they go back to pharmaceuticals? Do we have any of that data?
We have some, but it's not very much. And I'll say sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. And I think a lot of the time, even when the person goes back to it afterwards, they sort of feel that it was a worthy exploration. Many people will say something like, I've just been taking this antidepressant for a while. I feel like it might be limiting some emotion that I have, or I'm not sure how well it's working anymore, or for the level it's working, it kind of has a side effect burden that I don't like. And so they're basically like probably the most common reason is like, why do you want to taper an antidepressant? Probably the most common answer is so I can know myself better is usually the most like common answer that I get. So I think that if persons can successfully taper and use psychedelics a few times, they might eventually conclude that, you know what, like, I think I do need some of this, but they can conclude that from a much more informed kind of place and can potentially be happier with that medication regimen because they did do it and they did try the other thing. You know, in general, I try to really counsel people that there could be a way, particularly with psilocybin, I think of kind of making them both work. But most of the data at this point is suggesting they are kind of counterproductive in some kind of way.
The pharmaceuticals can shut down or someone can't have a full experience.
Yeah, like they diminish effects of psychedelics, either subjective experience or potentially some of the neuroplasticity and things of that nature. So there could be a way, like there could be a middle ground, particularly with psilocybin, with ketamine, definitely, because they're compatible. But for the most part, like your MDMA, your ayahuasca, the interactions are a little bit more significant or could actually be dangerous. I'm usually counseling people that, you know, these are paths that are more or less mutually exclusive at this point in time. Maybe there will be some more information that convinces us that you can do both. But I'm sort of thinking that, okay, if you want to try MDMA assisted therapy, the data from phase 3 out of MAPS is suggesting that 2 sessions works better than 1 and 3 sessions works better than 2. And that third session makes a massive difference for a lot of people as far as like achieving remission. And they're spaced about a month apart. So if you're really thinking, wow, I'm going to budget maybe 2 to 4 months to taper my antidepressant, I'm going to budget at least 2 weeks. But honestly, I think it would be better to budget more like 4 to 6 weeks as far as like a washout period. Just even before attempting the first experience, then I'm going to do 3 experiences a month apart. It's sort of, and then I'm going to do some integration work between and after. It's kind of like, man, that's a year right there, right? It's a huge kind of commitment to go down that road or go down that path. And now the antidepressants. Okay, when you start an antidepressant, it doesn't work immediately. You have to take it for some period of time. There might be a dose increase or two. So oftentimes it takes 6 to 12 weeks to get a person on a dose that is right for them, that they're finding helpful. And if you can get there and they find it helpful, depends on which illness you have, but the guidelines are essentially once you get a person well, you should continue it on that dose for like 6 to 18 months before trying to taper it. So both of these things, I'm sort of thinking if you really want to do a course of MDMA-assisted therapy, that's a minimum of 5 months, even with no antidepressant tapering and whatnot involved. If you really want to use antidepressants correctly, you're probably looking at 9 to 12 months of administration there. So this sort of idea that I'm going to like jump off my antidepressant for a couple of weeks and then have one MDMA experience and then go back onto it, it's flawed. And I think there's probably more risk than benefit in that plan overall. And I'm trying to kind of get away from the idea of psychedelics being a mystical bullet or one experience being enough. I mean, the phase 3 trial that MAPS has published, right? The number that go into remission after the first experience is about 8%. Technically, you would need to subtract off the number that went into remission from placebo. That looked like 2 or 3%. So I'm kind of thinking, you want to do one MDMA experience and think that you're going to be in remission for your PTSD symptoms long term, your chances are about 1 in 20. Not that great, actually, right?
Now, honestly, from your own experience, because I can say from like maybe my personal experience as well as working with people, that even 3 seems to be a low number. I know that MAPS is basically saying after 3, the number of people that are experiencing PTSD is what is the percentage they're saying?
okay, so I've been talking about remission. That's what I've been saying, which is basically an absence of PTSD symptoms anymore, where you couldn't even receive a diagnosis. But response is just a 50% reduction in symptoms. So if you're looking at the three MDMA sessions, after the three sessions, almost 80% have a response. So almost 80% got a 50% reduction in symptoms. So four out of five got something pretty good out of it, right? Whereas it's more like 30% actually achieved remission, which is still great. I mean, that's better than any other treatment for PTSD that we're aware of at this point in time, right? So it's still pretty good, but it took those three sessions. And yeah, to your point, man, if you just tapered an antidepressant and you're maybe expecting the first experience to be a little weaker, / I'm always thinking the first experience is about meeting the substance, getting through it safely. If you really have a therapeutic benefit from it, awesome. I think we're shooting for that, but really just having the person safely go through it, learn something about themselves, and wanting to engage with that modality again in about a month is more or less my goals or expectations for the first kind of session. And yeah, to your point, it's kind of like, well, I mean, to run these trials, it's a lot of money.
Yeah. So three's good.
Right. So it's kind of like, hey, we got 80% better. Basically, like, could you add a fourth or fifth session on for the ones that hadn't achieved remission yet? Would that be a really cool thing to do, to study, to see if you really do get bigger drops in the persons that were maybe a little med resistant or had a harder time kind of getting into the therapy out of the gate? It's a worthy experiment. I'll say, like, there have been some observational kind of data that's come out looking at like naturalistic psychedelic use, so more like home administration and things like that.
Now, who's doing this study?
I think it was a group out of UCSF. I believe Andrew Penn was one of the authors. I forget. But I think they found around 7 or 8. Like, if a person ingests psychedelics like 7 or 8 times, then up to that point, they tend to endorse that they're feeling better and getting better. And then after that, it's kind of diminishing returns. Like, a person might have an interesting experience, they might learn something about themselves, but are they really moving the chains as far as reduction of symptoms and mental health types of stuff? It seems like it kind of dried up there.
What you were just talking about with MDMA is, and the results of MDMA that are really better than any results we have right now, is also true, isn't it, about like an ibogaine with addiction. Would you say that even mushroom, psilocybin for addiction, and ibogaine for addiction, we're seeing better results than anything that we have on the market yet?
I will say that it's hard because the things that we have on the market have all been studied in randomized double-blinded trials, where if you're talking about psilocybin for tobacco cessation, well, that's a pilot study. You're talking about all the ibogaine data. Some of it's quite strong in that they're cohort studies. They're following the people, but it's still not randomized and double-blinded. There's a lot of people that are typically lost to follow-up in those types of things, where you're kind of like, okay, if you're lost to follow-up, does that mean you relapsed and that's why they couldn't get a hold of you, or you just moved countries or something? You know, you just don't know, right? It's lost to follow-up. So I'll say, like, particularly ibogaine, there's a lot of stuff preclinically that suggests it's powerfully anti-addictive. You have these observational sorts of reports of persons detoxifying from opioids, or beating like a cocaine dependence with it and things like that. I believe it, right? I believe it. But it's really hard to compare to other interventions, / it's actually you're not allowed to do that unless it's all done in the same study. Like, if you wanted to test methadone versus ibogaine, it might be hard to set up the groups in a way that there was like good blinding and things like that. But maybe theoretically you could do something like that. Psilocybin did have a randomized trial demonstrating it reduces heavy drinking recently. So that one's getting a little bit stronger as far as an indication. And I think just historically, you've got Krebs and Johansson's meta-analysis of LSD's randomized trials from like the 50s and 60s, even demonstrating back then, when we knew nothing about set and setting or psychedelic assisted therapy, or I'll say like little compared to today. And like the experiments are mishmash, right? Where it's kind of like some, it's like literally we brought them in and counseled them for 90 minutes and then gave them 400 micrograms of LSD, right? It's like in today's age, that would almost be like unethical as far as like, can you really dose them with high dose LSD after just talking for an hour and a half? Like it seems so skimpy and minimal compared to what they're doing in the trials today, but they still saw reductions in alcohol use and makes you wonder like, okay, if it would have been like this kind of gold standard psychedelic therapy intervention, like maybe the results would be even stronger. You don't know. So I will say that is one area where psychedelics, I think, hold some, well, maybe even for depression or PTSD, like maybe they work better than antidepressants. But that's one thing that we're relatively clear on is that those SSRI antidepressants are not addiction medicine per se. They're oftentimes part of like a dual diagnosis treatment plan because it's sort of recognized that substance use is comorbid with psychiatric illness almost all the time, but they're not anti-addictive in and of themselves, whereas psychedelics quite probably are anti-addictive in and of themselves.
And what about like SSRIs and mood stabilizers and other medicines that people are using for addiction or depression? What is your thought of being on those long-term? Because it seems like people go on them and then they might switch up which medicine they're on, but they stay on them for life sometimes.
I think it's very individual. I think it's really hard to say. I mean, I met people that are kind of like, I was given a bipolar diagnosis and I tried every single one of these and I got every single adverse reaction and side effect and the diagnosis was crap anyway. And now I found mushrooms and everything's peaceful, right? And then I've met other people that it's kind of like, man, my whole life I kind of like resisted this and then I finally gave in to the idea that I might have a bipolar 2 condition or be on a bipolar spectrum and I got on some lamotrigine or Lamictal and I started a low dose of lithium and it's like magic. So, right, there's some people that are on the methadone or Suboxone types of drugs and they're kind of like, God, I really wish I could get off of this. It's so hard. The tapering of buprenorphine is very difficult. It's a very tight binding drug to the opiate receptor. I've been taking it for 12 years, geez. But the reality is they would have died 12 years ago if they didn't get it. Some situations are not ideal. Some people are kind of disenchanted and they wish it was different.
I want to talk to you about your recent blog post that you did on, I get a lot of mothers reaching out and asking me what I feel about microdosing and breastfeeding or while they're pregnant. And then the other thing I often get too is a lot of people reporting that they already are and the benefits that they've had. And do I know the safety of these things? And I know just to start that there's a lot we don't know because there hasn't been enough research yet in this particular field of psychedelics, earth medicines, and motherhood in particular pregnancy. First of all, thank you so much for doing that research. That had to have taken a lot of time. It seems like it was a real in-depth look at what we do know. So thank you first for doing that. What did you find out?
Basically, we don't know very much, right? It would be like the summary. But you can find, for example, more stuff anthropologically talking about women that are pregnant or nursing using, I'd say, like naturally occurring tryptamine-based psychedelics like psilocybin mushrooms or ayahuasca. Not an endorsement of safety per se, just that you can find some information that that has been done historically and that there hasn't really been a great study of it. But at the same time, it's not one of these things that's well known not to do because there's problems and birth defects and things of that nature around it. MDMA, it's a designer amphetamine. There is some more observational types of studies out there demonstrating some harm and developmental, like neurodevelopmental kind of like issues with newborns that persist up to like age like 2. But these experiments are really heavily confounded. If you look at the methods, it's like literally mothers that used ecstasy. I forget. It's like more times than I've ever used it in my life. It's like 60 to 80 times, like during pregnancy or something like that. And they're smoking cigarettes and drinking alcohol and using other sorts of stuff. And so it's like, gosh, I don't think it really gives us a too accurate of a picture of the risks of MDMA-assisted therapy in that type of setting. But I will say that it is just more broadly than that. Like, you can look at those experiments and be like, come on, spirit pharmacist, why are you signing that? That's trash, right? And some people have, right? And it's like, okay, fair enough. There's a qualifying line in the article that says it's heavily confounded with these things, right? So it's like, it's not like I'm trying to pretend that I didn't notice that about it or something. Much more broadly, it's fairly well known that amphetamines are fat soluble, they cross placental barriers, they concentrate in breast milk, and they're just not good for fetuses or newborns, period, right? So, okay, methylenedioxymethamphetamine, it's different than amphetamine, but not that much, right? Like, not to the point where, like, having this magical thinking around MDMA is totally safe in that setting, but regular amphetamine isn't. So there's some extrapolation going on with that, and the data is not perfect and has some flaws in it. But I really do think MDMA and the designer amphetamines, the enactogens, essentially probably have higher risks than the naturally occurring tryptamines do.
What do you think about nursing and breastfeeding? And again, I want to say that due to the illegality of these medicines, this isn't endorsement or medical advice. But what are your thoughts from a pharmacological point of view?
Nursing and breastfeeding is probably a lower risk time to be using psychedelics than during the pregnancy itself. Like, I think that sounds sort of reasonable, particularly if the kid is 6 months. It seems like the information that we have sort of suggests by that age, usually the child is robust enough that the risks of drugs concentrating in breastfeeding and really causing problems tends to go down a little bit. And then breastfeeding too is also a situation where you do like a pump and dump method where you can like express breast milk ahead of time, freeze it, hold it for some period of time, like not give it out of the breast, but like give the frozen breast milk, thawed out first, heat it up a little, that kind of thing.
How much would, say, like someone was doing a microdose of, let's say, 0.1 milligrams of psilocybin, how long would that stay in the system if you were nursing?
If you look at the half-life of psilocybin, it would probably stay in the system about 24 hours. And the half-life of the drug is just an intrinsic property of the drug. It actually doesn't really change based on the dose that you're ingesting. But the blood concentrations change. Like, the time to 50% of the elimination doesn't change, but the blood concentrations will really change depending on the dose, right? So I think when I'm thinking like the pump and dump kind of thing, I'm kind of thinking more like full dose psychedelic assisted therapy, whereas microdosing is the kind of thing where, boy, I wish there was just more information about it, period. You know, like, difference between medicine and poison is dose, like we were saying, and sort of like, okay, the kid's more than 6 months of age, they're robust, and you want to try microdosing because you have some postpartum depression and feel like it really helped some connection or like bonding perhaps with your child. It's like, it all sounds like super reasonable. It's just not something that we can be like, yeah, that's safe, that's efficacious, that kind of thing. But
so going back to what you just said, just so I understand, so someone microdosing or someone going in and doing like a 3-gram therapeutic session with somebody, that's staying in the system for the same amount of time.
5 elimination half-lives is 5 elimination half-lives, right? Because the elimination half-life, by definition, is a 50% reduction in blood concentration. So it's relative to where the blood concentration is, but the time for the 50% reduction is the same. Like, it's an intrinsic property of the drug half-life.
Speaking of, I want to talk about two things that came up in one of the calls we did that I'm curious about. One was some new evidence about microdosing and the heart. And second was some of the new information on cannabis and psychosis. Could you speak to both of those?
So serotonergic psychedelics like MDMA or psilocybin, the two most like common substances that persons microdose, they bind serotonin receptors, and we think they produce most of their psychedelic effects by binding to serotonin 2A receptors. But you have serotonin 2B receptors on heart valves, and there's been several drugs that the FDA has pulled from the market over the years because of valvular heart disease, or essentially like a fibrotic or like scarred type of heart valve. And this is a serious problem. If it occurs, the fix is open heart surgery, right? So it's not something that you just take a medication and it gets a little bit better or that kind of thing. And when it occurs, it's usually irreversible or partially reversible, right? Basically, it's a serious adverse effect. It's associated with chronic use of serotonin 2B receptor activating drugs, right? So it's not something you will ever see from intermittent use of psychedelics. And we're not sure that we'll see it from microdosing or semi-chronic use of psychedelics, but it's possible because they bind serotonin 2B receptors.
So just based on that knowledge, what would your suggestion be when it comes to microdosing? Take breaks?
Limit the course, 1 to 2 months of microdosing, and then a break time that's about half that long. So if I do 1 month of microdosing, 2 weeks off, I do 2 months of microdosing, 1 month off. Sometimes people are like, I'm going to be without for like a month. And it's like, okay, well, you can do it this way. You can do 2 months of microdosing, take a month off. In the middle of that month, you can schedule one macrodose session. So that way you do your cycle of microdosing, 2 weeks to air out and reset your tolerance completely. You get your big dose session, 2 weeks of integration. You want to start another cycle of microdosing after that, you can, right? So it's sort of like you've got this sort of thing to look forward to in that month off, and you're taking the time off to just air out a little bit, reset your tolerance, maybe go a little bit bigger, have some more effect if you want that, right? If you don't need it, then don't do that.
And then what about psychosis and cannabis?
Well, heavy cannabis use in adolescent years is definitely a risk factor for psychosis. Like, is it a causal type of thing? Well, that's where all the controversy is, right?
Are we seeing more of it, though?
I'm not aware of seeing more of it because I don't think teenage or cannabis use is necessarily on the rise. I haven't really heard or seen much around that. There's probably other factors, right? There's like usually some kind of predisposition to psychotic illness. There's been some other genes associated with it, like if you have differences in some metabolic enzymes like catechol-O-methyltransferase, things like that. It's fairly non-controversial that heavy cannabis use isn't the greatest for a developing or adolescent kind of brain. It probably is not going to cause schizophrenia in the vast majority of persons, but maybe it does hasten the onset of the first psychotic break in some persons.
So I know we're kind of closing down here. I just want to ask you also, just in your own personal experience of different medicines, whether you have felt a particular medicine to be one of the most profound teachers for you.
They've all taught me something profound at some point or time in my life. But I would say for a while, I kind of considered ketamine to sort of be the bastard stepchild of serotonergic psychedelics or something like that. Like, it's not a psychedelic, it's a dissociative anesthetic, and it's habit forming and addictive, and psychiatry isn't endorsing it, but before these other ones. And so there was just like a lot of, I would say, like personal stigma I had in my mind around ketamine. But over the last, I would say, like 3 years or so, ketamine has done so much as far as like healing my physical body and teaching me how to heal my own physical body. Like telling me, these are the movements that you do when you feel this certain thing. This is the way to release it, right? And it's gotten to the point where, I mean, I prefer to do it with ketamine, but I don't need it. I can recognize these things and do these techniques and they work for me.
And are you talking about a low dose?
The dose varies. The dose, the route of administration, things like that. It's kind of varied, right? But really, I started that in around 2020. Or so. And at that point in the time, I was burnt out, depressed, working 2 full-time jobs, waking up 2-3 in the morning, brewing a pot of coffee, going straight to work. I was waking up because I had back pain. I couldn't even take a deep breath. My diaphragm was like so tight and whatnot. And now I sleep through the night. I wake up without pain. I'm so freaking happy for that. Most of my 20s, I had like once a year where I'd have just an attack of like back spasms for about a month, and then it would kind of go. But throughout my 20s, I could not do a sit-up because of this like back pain. It would never truly go away. Like I would have the spasms, and then the spasms would subside, but the injury was still there. And I could not, literally, I would roll on my side and get up this way, and that's how I do it. Now, I do sit-ups. I can do like ab regimens and things like that. It's amazing. And it was ketamine that did it.
How often can you take ketamine for it to be safe?
Oh, well, I would say like the induction round is usually like twice a week for 6 or 8 administrations. That's like the evidence-based induction round. But honestly, I tried to do that in 2020. I gave up by the middle of the second week because I already developed a tolerance to it. It's like, if I'm using this, I want it to be special. I don't want to have this tolerance to it. I understand that higher and higher doses to achieve the same effect is a hallmark of a habit-forming or addictive kind of drug. And I know ketamine is habit-forming and addictive. I sort of put some like rules and boundaries around like I'm not going to like disclose the doses per se, but I sort of said like, this is your dose cap. And if this is not good enough for you, this means that you need to spend more time between the administrations rather than I'm going to keep using higher doses. And so it's very interesting that I would say like the standard kinds of induction round for ketamine, at least for me, was something that squarely built tolerance very rapidly. And I just kind of felt like, why would I want to do that? Like, that doesn't really make a lot of logical sense to me. Where I've found that fairly regularly, to be honest, every 7 to 14 days is enough to keep it pretty dang special each time. And that is enough time for myself personally for it to be special and for it to be not habit forming. Like, it's up on a shelf somewhere, it's in a safe, it's out of the way. I don't think about it. Like, it doesn't like preoccupy my like thoughts and this and that. It has its like time and place. There's a ritual around it, right? Like, I usually do something where I go outside for a bit. I do some kind of like physical activity. I usually do some kind of like stretching to like try to like open the physical body a little bit ahead of time. And then I like David G a lot. I use like one of like David G's like guided meditations to kind of like calm the mind a little bit. And at that point, I just kind of like feel ready and go for it. It's just been such a wonderful practice. And not to discount the profundity of the lessons of other psychedelics and things like that, but I think like ketamine has done something to me that no other psychedelic has been able to do. And at this point, I'm kind of thinking, people like, what do you think about ketamine? My answer is like, well, you know, you got to put some safeguards around it. But if I had to describe it in one word, it would be underrated.
You know, it's interesting. I had the same kind of idea about ketamine. It was just all that you said in my mind. And I've only done it once. And it was probably one of the most profound experiences of all my psychedelic experiences. I was shocked.
As far as true mystical experiences and effects, I think ketamine might be king, to be honest.
I was shocked. And a friend was like, try it. I'm like, I have no interest. I literally have no interest. And I was very surprised. I could talk for like 3 more hours. I have so many more questions. Maybe we'll have you back. How can people find you?
Yeah, so spiritpharmacist.com is my website. I also do some social media on Instagram and Facebook. Less often LinkedIn, but sometimes there. Signing up for my email list is probably the best way to stay in touch with what I'm doing. I send out usually a monthly newsletter as well as some other types of educational resources, events, promotional stuff I've got going on, things like that. So the mailing list is probably like where you really get like the best of what I'm communicating, I guess. Those are the places and ways that people can find me. Yeah.
And you're doing some training for others, aren't you, in the pharmaceutical psychedelic space, some teaching?
Yeah. So particularly around screening, contraindications, things like that. I'm a guest facilitator in several different training programs. There's the FIVE training program that's often through Kalvaya Collective or Tandava Retreats. I still believe there is the Synthesis training program. It's kind of been up and down and things like that, right? But I was a part of that one. I did Cherie Psychedelic Play School. I did last year. I did Lorna and Entheo Nations like Plant Spirit School. I did a module there. I did like kind of like a, I think it was more like a one-time facilitation or screening lecture for the Microdosing Institute.
Thank you for the work that you're doing. It's vital in this space, keeping people safe, giving the recommendations that you are. It's truly remarkable. I'm really grateful that you're out there doing this work.
I'm grateful too. Like, it's literally something that I really enjoy doing, and it's something that people really appreciate. And whether you want to believe life has a purpose or not, it sure feels good to be in a place where you're doing something you like and something that people appreciate.
Well, thank you so much, Ben.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed today's show and want to help build a more beautiful, conscious, and loving world, please share this content with friends, family, and colleagues.
You can follow this show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. And I'd really appreciate you taking the time to write a review so that others can find these amazing conversations. And if you'd like to see a video version of the show, you can find me on YouTube. Feel free to reach out and connect with me at thepsychedelicmom.com or message me on Instagram at thepsychedelicmom. And remember, you are the medicine.